Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Like a lot of other Americans, young Americans have been hit hard by nearly half a dozen years of economic upheaval. But it's different to be hit this way when you're young. It can reset your entire outlook, your deep expectations. My guest today says it's rewriting a generation's very understanding of what adulthood is and can be. This hour on Point, young Americans, especially the low-income young, redefining the American dream. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Young listeners, are your expectations, your dreams, different from your parents? How? Why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Jennifer Silva, sociologist, fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and author of the new book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. You can find an excerpt of her book at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer Silva, welcome to On Point. It's so good to have you right here.
Thank you so much.
We've heard a lot about this. We've heard now for years, literally, about young college graduates, community college graduates, high school graduates, knocked back on their heels, going back home, sort of letting go of, well, certainly running into awfully big headwinds. You've gone out and talked with a lot of them. Who'd you talk to? What did you find?
So I went into two communities, Lowell, Massachusetts, and Richmond, Virginia.
Okay.
And I tracked down young men and women who are trying to grow up, who are trying to get stable jobs, who are trying to start families, move out of their parents' house, pay their own bills, go to college. And I went to service sector workplaces and colleges and military bases and traditional blue-collar workplaces like fire stations and police stations. And I asked people, what is it like to grow up today? What do you want? What stands in your way?
What did you find?
I found that there are many obstacles that work against these young men and women's attempts to create stable adult lives. I find that they are stuck in a labor market that is very insecure. They never know if they'll be employed next week. They're never sure if they'll get a 40-hour work week. Many of them don't have benefits, and that makes it very hard to plan for the future.
You focused in particular, we see it right in your title, on working class young Americans. How do you define that? What do you mean by that? And why did you focus on that sector?
I focused on young men and women who grew up in families where their parents didn't have college degrees.
Okay.
And the reason I did that is because the family is basically the only safety net that young men and women have today. It's sort of up to the individual family to launch young men and women into the future. So for, you know, wealthy parents who have advanced degrees, you know, maybe they can call a friend and get their kid an internship, or they can pay for graduate school or pay for an internship. Mm. However, the parents who have, you know, simply a high school degree, they're struggling in the labor market as well. They're watching their jobs grow increasingly insecure and maybe losing their pensions or paying more for their benefits. And because they haven't been to college themselves, they don't always have the knowledge and the tools to help their kids navigate this new labor market where a college degree is so important.
So I know you've looked back as well as looked at what's in front of us right now with this challenge. If you look at these young Americans and their parents, take us sort of back and forth here. What were their parents' expectations as they came out of high school or community college or college? I guess not college in this case. But as they entered the workplace, entered their 20s or late teens, what were their expectations? How do those compare with their children's, young Americans now?
So for their parents and their grandparents, there was an expectation of what we think of as a traditional adulthood. So you leave school at 18, you move out of your parents' house. For men, you get a job and you start supporting a family. For women, you kind of take charge of the household and you raise children. So there are these very deeply gendered and separate roles for men and women. Mm. And they're very stable roles. You know, once you leave your parents' house, you establish your own household, you join the community as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so the young men and women I spoke to, many of their parents had gone through this kind of transition, but then it was threatened. So maybe that stable job that the dad got at a factory was taken away, or maybe someone got hurt in an injury and they were on disability and they, you know, couldn't support the family. Or maybe their parents got divorced and they grew up with a lot of family chaos and didn't really believe in that traditional model of marriage.
So you're saying that their parents may have started out and probably did with this sort of pretty clear set of work, house, marriage, community engagement. For a lot of these kids, you're saying that fell apart even before it came to their generation.
That's right. That's right. So their parents are undergoing the same kind of tumultuous adulthood in some ways that their children then inherit.
And the right. And the young Americans that you talk to then, when it comes to their expectations now on work, home, marriage, community engagement?
You know, it's very interesting because many of them have a sort of idealized or nostalgic image of what it means to be an adult that is not actually based on their own parents or grandparents. And so I was very shocked to hear young men, you know, in their late 20s saying things like, I always imagined myself growing old with my wife, sitting on a porch, surrounded by white picket fences, listening to the Dick Van Dyke Show. Okay. Or, you know, I had one woman say to me, oh, I wish I could be, you know, barefoot and pregnant in a kitchen and be taken care of by a man instead of having to go work in a coffee shop. And so there was almost this longing to return to this idealized notion of a past. And I think that's because their lives felt so unstable that they were almost yearning for these much more rigid adult roles.
So what are their expectations now when it comes to work, when it comes to where they'll live, when it comes to partnering up?
So they all, most of them understand that they need a college degree in order to get ahead. So they hear it from their schools, their parents, their friends. They know that they need to go to school in order to make it. However, once they enter college, they run into a lot of trouble because they don't have all of the knowledge and skills and tools you need to succeed. So maybe they'll end up taking out tens of thousands of dollars in loans and then majoring in something where they don't, you know how to use that major to get a professional job.
You described somebody who went in thinking they'd be an engineer, couldn't cut the math, turned to criminal justice,
exactly.
I think. And even then felt kind of betrayed when she hit the workforce, no job.
And then couldn't get hired as a police officer, which is, you know, very competitive job. And then ends up in the service economy feeling kind of betrayed, saying, I had a degree. You know, this degree was supposed to be my ticket to the land of milk and honey. And what happened?
Betrayal is a big theme here in your conversations, your many interviews with these young people. Why?
It's almost as if every institution that these young men and women come up against lets them down. And that's not always necessarily the fault of an institution, but there is a mismatch between the expectations and the knowledge and the skills of these young men and women and the institution itself. For example, as I was saying, in education, you know, not maybe going to college and taking out $80,000 in loans and then, you know, majoring in something that won't get you a job. These young men and women feel like they did the right thing. They went to college, but why doesn't it pay off for me? So they feel very betrayed.
Betrayed by who or what?
They don't really know how to put a finger on it, just sort of betrayed by a system. And often that kind of translates into government. So, you know, maybe someone will be taxed for not purchasing health insurance in Massachusetts. And then they feel very betrayed by this government because they say, I didn't know I had to sign up or I didn't know how.
There's work. Are they expecting careers? It's been a rough patch here since the severe downturn. Are they expecting careers to turn up at some point or are they resigning themselves? I mean, you've got a lot of people in here who are bouncing around service sector jobs in retail. Do they expect better at some point to come along?
They hope so. They have a really hard time imagining what those jobs would look like because they don't know a lot of people who have stable professional jobs. So someone might say, one young man said to me, oh, I always thought I'd wear a suit and I'd own things. But he doesn't really understand what that job, you know, would look like in that suit. And so it's very hard.
Puts it almost in fantasy land.
It's almost in fantasy land. I mean, I had another young man tell me he always thought he'd be a Ninja Turtle. So it's very hard for them to imagine their futures, not knowing anyone who has these really stable jobs.
You're right about this turning them in on themselves in many ways and a mood economy. What's the mood economy?
That's a great question. So the men and women I spoke to really can't depend on these external markers of adulthood. They can't say, look, I moved out of my parents' house, I got a degree, I got married and stayed married. And so they're kind of turning inward. So they're marking their progress into adulthood by saying, look at me, I grew up in a really troubled family and it made me depressed or it gave me anxiety, but I learned how to turn my life around on my own. I learned that I don't have to depend on anyone else to make me happy.
Don't have a house, don't have a marriage maybe, don't have a good job maybe, but I'm dealing with my emotions.
Exactly. I'm dealing with my troubled past. Maybe I overcame an addiction. Maybe I've resolved to make myself happy.
Is that a low bar or a high bar?
I think it's making a virtue kind of out of what they have left. I don't think they have many other markers left.
Wow. We're going to dive right on in here with Jennifer Silva. Her new book is coming up short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Here's Fleet Foxes with Helplessness Blues. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, sure, take all that you see to the men who move on me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how economic headwinds are changing young Americans' ideas about adulthood and the American dream, blowing away for many old dreams of marriage, home ownership, even kids. My guest is Jennifer Silva. She's author of the new book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. We're going to be joined a little later in this hour by Justin St. Germain. His new memoir, Son of a Gun, is getting a lot of attention these days. And it's set in some of this terrain that he knows. He'll join us from New Mexico. Jennifer Silva is with me in the studio. And we've got lots of response here, Jennifer, online. I mean, Lewis says, for me, just to get an apartment, I would need a second job or two or three roommates. Desiree says, lots of promises were made about the value of a degree that were greatly overstated. Here's Mike. So far, I've adapted by not buying anything I want or going anywhere I'd like to see. New car, washing machine. Unattainable, now or in the future. I work full-time for barely $25,000 a year with a bachelor's degree. And here's John. I'm taking a little license here, but he says, the dream, freedom. The reality, be poor, fat, and use social media. Okay, that sounds pretty depressing. Is this as depressing as it can sound?
I think it is. Over and over again, I heard young people basically expressing that they were sold fake goods. So they had these expectations. They thought they could go to college, get a good job, have a family. And they just kept hitting these barriers that held them back. And, you know, this reference to social media is interesting because, you know, many of the young people I spoke with do depend on Facebook to kind of tell their story because they feel so lonely and isolated. It's one of the only outlets they have.
Why lonely and isolated? How does that? I can imagine all kinds of other responses, solidarity and community. Why isolation?
The sense of betrayal that they feel in their families, in the educational system, with the government, in the military, leads them to embrace this ethos of, I have to go it alone. I can only depend on myself. Depending on other people will only hurt me in the end. And so they kind of make a virtue out of self-sufficiency. And so they reject solidarity because they don't trust other people to look out for them.
So it's kind of a Rand Paul view of the world, a kind of neoliberal view of the world.
Absolutely. It is rooted in these everyday instances of betrayal or bewilderment in institutions.
What about in intimate relationships? If they're not finding community solidarity, what about marriage and relationships? Where are they headed?
So many of the men and women have kind of given up on a lasting romantic relationship. So for men, the idea that men are expected to provide for a family makes it very difficult for them to imagine committing. So one young man told me, no woman wants to sit at home and eat Burger King. So until I can, you know, until I have a job, until I can afford to take out a woman, I'm basically giving up.
Does that mean they don't have relationships, or they just don't get married because they don't feel like they have the accoutrements of marriage?
Sort of a cycling in and out of relationships, so they're unstable and insecure, just like their jobs. And for women, actually, there's kind of this fear of depending on unreliable men. So women know that they can't depend on men the way they might have 50 or 60 years ago. They have to work. And so they kind of claim their independence by saying, why would I, you know, risk everything I have by depending on this man?
I mean, I read you exactly saying that women may not want to get into relationships because they can't depend on the guy. He could become a drag when they can't afford a drag.
That's right. So one woman said, you know, I'd rather be alone and fierce than be in a relationship and be milquetoast. You know, they don't want to lose that hard-won security or stability they have.
What's your sense of where this new outlook, their experience and the way they see the world that results from it, where does this take us?
I think it's very scary to imagine a future where people are turning inward, are measuring progress and defining their lives in terms of their own triumphs instead of reaching out to others or building communities or solidarity with others.
And even redefining what triumph means, as you describe it. I mean, this is not a triumph of, boy, I've got a great career going now.
Exactly. It's not I have a great career. It's not, you know,
I'm getting by.
Exactly. I'm getting by and I'm willing myself to be happy with what I have.
I'm not drowning, so it's triumph. Jennifer Silva is with us. Her book is Coming Up Short. Justin St. Germain joins us in a moment. A couple of calls here. Darren in Nashville, Tennessee. Darren, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jennifer. Great topic. I'm really kind of frothing at the bit here, trying to find out what Jennifer has. She's been really objective. Thank you very much, Jennifer. A lot of guests come in and want to pepper their pepper with commentary, but I'd like to know what your opinion of this. I'm going to call this, the why me generation, because I really don't have a whole lot of sympathy on this, because I was 30 years old. I'm 38 now. When I entered the workforce, it was extremely difficult when I started out, but I'm a hard worker. My parents instilled that. I worked since I was about 12. Summer jobs to pay for my school clothes, because we didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I just, what do you think about, they're saying they're going inward and they, rely on Facebook, and no one wants, because I don't want my, girlfriend or fiance or wife to eat McDonald's. That just sounds like a lot of, kind of boo-hooing. And I'm an entrepreneur. My mother told me, the only future you'll have is the future you make for yourself. And that's really, I think about it all the time, because if I don't do it, who else is going to? And you have to reach out and you meet other people with that same like-mindedness, that drive. And it's hard. It's not easy. I mean, I struggle. I work a lot of hours.
Yeah.
But I'm not complaining, and I'm not woe is me. And I'd like to know what Jennifer thinks about, if that's the mentality. I mean, really, where are we at? Because that's very scary.
Yeah, yeah. Scary. Darren, let me give it right to Jennifer. It's weak, it's wimpy, it's boo-hooing. Just do it. What you hear Darren's perspective. What do you say?
Well, I think what's so fascinating is that these young men and women are the first to blame themselves, are the first people to say, no one is going to fix me but me, or if I would only take a risk and move to another city, then I would be totally fine. So it's my fault I'm not making it. So in a sense, they're saying the exact same thing you are about themselves.
Not self-pitying?
There's very little self-pity. It's, they say, I had a difficult past, but it's up to me to fix it. It's up to me to go take out loans and go to college. It's up to me to move to another city.
But did you see a bunch of mini-me's of Darren out there? I'm going to just go do it, and by golly, I will.
Absolutely. My grandfather dug ditches. He worked his way up. Now he has a mansion. I need to do the same
thing. So why do you think it's striking Darren's ear as so unsatisfactory somehow?
I think it's because these young men and women are taking the wrong risks. So maybe they are saying, I need to depend only on myself. I should, go take out loans and try to get a degree. But they have very little guidance, and they have very little, even the, he's talking about his mom encouraging him or, you know, helping him figure out that he needed to take summer classes. A lot of the men and women I spoke with don't have that. And so they're kind of guessing how what they need to do to get ahead.
Darren's only 38. That's not that far ahead of this generation. He didn't join the workforce till he was 30, so he's almost in their cohort.
Sure. And he maybe is, you know, one of the kind of fortunate ones. But, you know, so many of the young men and women today are not fortunate or are not taking the right risks, or they're, you know, taking risks and working hard, but it's not paying off.
Darren, I appreciate your call. Caitlin in Beaufort, South Carolina. Caitlin, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm 19.
Okay.
And I wanted to go to school for aerospace engineering, but I can't because my dream college is $50,000 a year. And I come from kind of poverty, so I can't really force myself out there, and I don't see the point in taking out loans, which I won't be able to pay off.
Do you have to have your dream college to pursue your dream, Caitlin? Many don't.
I don't. It's still going to be a good 30 grand a year.
So where's that leave you? Are you going to try and put that together, or are you bagging it?
It leaves me working $2.13 as a server.
Plus tips, big tips, we hope.
No.
I mean,
people don't tip nowadays in our economy, but I can't get a job anywhere else because I've never had a job before.
So how do you see your future?
I hope that I can move forward, but I'm going to be struggling from here on out. I'm trying my best, but I'm going to probably work my way up to at least get a year or half a year paid of college before I go into anything.
Even that can take a long time to save at that kind of wage. It's a pretty daunting prospect. Caitlin, I appreciate your call. Jennifer Silva, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Justin St. Germain, author of the really terrific new memoir, Son of a Gun. And there's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, getting rave reviews on this account of his own coming up kind of tough, and has worked with a lot of Native American and Latino young people trying to find their way at the University of New Mexico and beyond. Justin St. Germain in Albuquerque, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you hear in the portrait of a generation of young Americans that Jennifer Silva is sharing with us, kind of blaming themselves, feeling betrayed, and yet blaming themselves for the trouble at the same time, almost something a little contradictory there yet, dropping a lot of the elements of their parents' American dream. Maybe their parents didn't hit those anyway, but they had the dream. What do you hear in all this, Justin? How does it compare with what you're seeing in the young people around you?
It absolutely translates to my experience, especially since I've been here at the University of New Mexico. I came here from Stanford, where obviously their prospects maybe were a little different. And especially the contrast in the assumption of what those prospects were and the awareness of what their opportunities were. I think a lot of students here are like you said, Native American, Latino. A lot are local. A lot are first generation college students. And I think it's true that that they're having a lot of difficulty, especially in as they graduate from college. And I see a lot of that self-blame. It's a really difficult thing to observe because you have these people who've accomplished this wonderful thing. They've worked really hard. They're the first people in their families to graduate from college. But then there's a real sort of despair when they graduate about what they're going to do. And a lot of times it translates into self-blame that maybe they made some sort of bad decision. And obviously, you really hate to see that in somebody who's worked so hard and who's achieved so much.
What do you think it means for the country, Justin, if people start kind of dropping out of the old American dream? I mean, it's had its sort of punkiness for a while now, right? Not everybody achieved it by any mean, but it's been out there as an aspiration. I don't know, marriage, house, sort of membership in a community, sense of pride in a career. What if that gets really diluted? What's it mean, Justin?
I don't know what it means. I certainly think it's a very dangerous thing. I mean, because it is true that I don't see a lot of assumption of that same dream. I think that idea has changed pretty radically. I'm sort of on the cusp of the generation maybe we're talking about. I'm 32,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of my students are younger, and it's just not there. I think those core ideas of what the American dreams mean, American dream means, are not the same. I think it just means surviving in a lot of cases. I think it means not having to go back to wherever they're from, whatever situation that they've transcended, whether that's, you know, living on the reservation and sort of unfortunate circumstances, or whether that means coming from, you know, there is, as Jennifer's mentioned, a lot of backgrounds with addiction and various kinds of abuse. And I think on one hand, the American dream, maybe, you know, I see a lot of truth in what she's saying about how for them, they're equating achievement to transcending those circumstances. And less about sort of economic markers.
Yeah, but just coping. I mean, survival and coping are pretty low bars. You previously taught at Stanford, Justin. You said it was quite different there. Now, there you may have more affluent young people. You may have super achievers. You know, is this just another example of our culture separating into different groups? You know, did they have super high expectations? Were they as high as young Americans in their situation as it is low in the other group you're looking at?
Absolutely. And I don't mean to say anything bad about Stanford students because they're really wonderful kids, but
sure.
But it's really just an assumption. It's not even necessarily an expectation. It's just, I don't even know that they're really aware of the assumptions they're making about what their opportunities are.
You mean assumption that, what, it's going to be great?
Yes, exactly. That they're going to, and really, usually it's a pretty wise assumption. It turns out to be true. You know, that they have these vast support networks in a lot of cases, and even if they don't, by the time they get to Stanford, they do. And, you know, they're getting internships, they have these really well-defined career paths that people are guiding them along, and they find it pretty easy to pursue them, I think. And I think one of the huge differences is just that there are a lot of lower-income students at Stanford. It's
mm-hmm,
not
sure.
Universally wealthy students, but
yeah.
But especially the wealthier students, there's also just that safety net to fall back on. If things don't work out, excuse me, they can, you know, they know they can go back home.
It's there for them. What's it mean, Jennifer? I mean, look, we've always had disparities of all kinds of things in this country, including opportunity.
Absolutely.
But maybe there was for many a shared dream. Now, if the dream isn't shared, even, what's it mean?
It means that we are increasingly living into Americas, where you see these upper class or privileged kids growing up, getting good jobs, and they are delaying adulthood for sure. They're getting married maybe when they're 30 and they're having kids later. But that's because both men and women are investing in education and are having very stable jobs. And then you have this other half, and this other half is in and out of relationships, in and out of jobs, can't depend on anyone. And
is this really new? I mean, you know, go back. You know, you're talking with Daniel Patrick Moynihan years ago, you know, about very different circumstances for different people. Certainly Latinos in this country, immigrants, have known some pretty tough challenges. All kinds of minority groups have over the years. And plenty of white poverty has been there over the years. Is it really so different today?
I think that we see a shift in the kinds of inequalities that we're dealing with. So 50 or 60 years ago, gender was something that definitely held people back, right? As a woman, you couldn't necessarily go to college or, you know, take out credit in your own name or buy a house. And certainly for ethnic minorities, there was a great deal of, you know, legal discrimination. And, however, we've seen a little bit of a loosening up of the gender discrimination. Women have more opportunities. You know, African Americans in some ways have more opportunities. However, those opportunities don't mean very much when there's so much class inequality, when you need a college degree in order to get ahead, but college degrees are more expensive and more complex.
And you're talking with young people who have them and still feel a sense of betrayal. They can't get that job. Jennifer Silva's new book is coming up short. Memoirist Justin St. Germain is with us. His wonderful memoir, Son of a Gun. Listeners, you can join us. Here's Drive-By Truckers working this job. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about how economic headwinds are changing young Americans' ideas about adulthood and the American dream, blowing away for many old dreams of marriage, home ownership, even kids. Jennifer Silva has been out talking with lots of young Americans, written up her findings in a new book, pretty terrific, called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. She's with me in the studio. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Justin St. Germain is here. His terrific new memoir, Son of a Gun, is out. Check it out. It's set in a world not so far from this one. He's 32 years old and spends a lot of time with young people, sees what they are up against. Jennifer, Justin, lots of response online. Heather says, I see the American dream as freedom. Most of us are not free. We're a nation of debtors or defaulters. Hardly anyone has true freedom. But was that so different in the day of the man in the gray flannel suit? I mean, you know, Justin, back in the day, people may have had a 9-to-5 job and didn't feel free there.
Certainly, yeah. And I understand that. You know, one of my grandfathers was a GM auto worker. The other one worked for a carpenter's union for his entire life. So I certainly understand that. I just think that the availability of those kinds of jobs, the ones on which you can build that sort of American dream, you know, middle-class lifestyle, they're a lot harder to get these days, it seems like, or at least if my students' experience and some of my own and friends is any indication.
Amy writes, Jennifer, we have a generation that got everything from their parents and expect that largesse to continue. So, you know, this kind of, and we've heard a lot of this in the last half dozen or so years, sort of whiny generation. Get out of the basement, you know, go out and just get on the stick.
I mean, I think we have a generation that has only their parents to depend on. So the last 30 or 40 years, we see, you know, the decline of communities, we see a decline of neighborhoods, churches, we see young adults growing up with basically only their own family to depend on. They're not embedded in these larger neighborhoods and communities that they might have been 50 or 60 years ago. And so, yes, they depend on their parents, but that's because there's no one else. Their safety net is limited to their parents.
I mean, is there a problem here? I mean, Coast writes, you know, it says, look, self-sufficiency, which you describe as their attitude, their go-to attitude ultimately, can be construed as Emersonian. You know, what's the problem with that? Self-sufficiency, old American way.
I think the problem is when you don't have the tools and the knowledge to make good decisions and good investments for your future. So I think it's great that people say I can, you know, lift myself up or I want to pull myself out of poverty and make it. But when they're then enrolling in a for-profit college and are $100,000 in debt and can't get a job, that's a real problem, not just for them, but for all of us.
Is this just inevitable in a period of relative economic stagnation? I mean, lots of people, you know, immigrants came to this country without a great toolkit of, you know, resources, and yet people made it because the economy was moving.
But I think we can also think about the kinds of resources that are shared within communities. You know, when I've interviewed people who grew up in the Depression, they talk about potluck dinners or maybe helping each other, whether through a pastor or, mm-hmm. you know, a teacher to figure out how to get ahead. And the young people I spoke with don't have those kinds of social safety nets available. They really are on their own.
Justin, do you see that kind of out there alone quality in your interactions?
I do, yeah. I more than I'd like to. And I think a lot of it just has to do with the fact that, you know, in a lot of cases, these students that I'm working with at UNM have had to leave their communities behind, and they do wind up not wanting to go back in a lot of cases, like I said, for various reasons, but a lot of them are, it's sort of the endemic working class, like problems that, you know, addiction, abuse, sort of, they're from small towns, things like that, and they don't want to go back to that, and so they find themselves a lot of times, I think Jennifer has a point about, you know, social media is their network, or their network is otherwise kind of non-existent.
I mean, isn't that a network, though? Social media, you would think that might come in, and okay, we don't have isn't many potlucks anymore, but Jennifer, what about social media? Shouldn't it provide some kind of connectivity?
So from what I've witnessed, it seems that people are able to share their story or reach out for help, but I very rarely see them get a response. Or maybe someone says, oh, that's really sad, I'm sorry to hear that, but there's no action. There's no organized action to try to help people or guide them.
It's not like, come on, be my apprentice, or come on, let's exactly. form a union, or let's start a company.
Yeah, and then on the internet, there's all kinds of, you know, bad information where maybe they think they have an opportunity and they end up you know, giving their credit card number to someone and getting exploited. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
The ripoff horizon. Let's go to New Orleans. Rachel's calling. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
I was calling to touch upon something that Jennifer said earlier, kind of the dichotomy she drew between people who were working class and their parents didn't go to college and they were kind of left high and dry trying to work it out for themselves, how to enter the workforce. and secure a good job versus people who did go through college and have more support. And my perspective as a young person who does have a college degree, and one of my parents went to college, I think it just takes a lot more creativity across the board and patience and resilience to make a place for yourself in the workforce. And that's something that I'm seeing in my life as a college graduate, is you have to be more creative because there's not necessarily that pathway to a good job with benefits right away.
What are you doing, Rachel? How old are you, and do you have a job?
Yes, I'm 23 years old. I have a college degree, and I've been working in a restaurant and working retail as I try to find a space for myself in the field I want to work in.
And what about those jobs and their prospects? Retail, restaurant.
Well, I think that what Jennifer touched upon with, you know, making those connections and kind of finding that community is so important, because without it, you're really not even going to hear about job openings when they do open. So I could see how not having a college degree, it can be kind of isolating trying to break into a steady job, because even with my degree, I've definitely had to become more outgoing than I ordinarily would be just to make connections and find out about job openings.
I mean, that's kind of the way, in some ways, it's always worked. You've got to be out there and working. What about your dreams, Rachel? Do you dream of the, you know, the standard old picture, the, you know, the house with the picket fence, the family, the long-term career?
I haven't given up on those dreams just yet, but I'm realizing that it takes a lot longer and it doesn't come easy. I think that growing up, you have this idea that if you go to college, you work hard, you're automatically going to secure that for yourself. But what I'm realizing is you definitely have to build something for yourself. You have to be creative, and it takes a lot of time and effort. And also, one of the things that I'm realizing is that so much of a good life is about the family you have and the people that you get through things with. So even if you're at the top, if you're there all alone, it's not going to be worth it. So going through these trials and trying to secure a job in my field has definitely made me realize the importance of family and friends.
Rachel, I really appreciate your call. Now, Jennifer, there's Rachel in New Orleans, and as she describes that, I don't know if that's something new or not. I can picture a lot of 60-something listeners nodding along and saying, hey, you're young. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It's not easy. You need your family. These don't sound like revolutionary new observations, as important as they are to any individual like Rachel.
Well, what's so interesting is that Rachel talks about how important it is to depend on your family, to be embedded in these extended kin networks, and that is certainly not new. What is, I think, new is how many of the young men and women I spoke with who see cutting ties, moving away from their family, and kind of depending on only themselves emotionally. That's how they're now defining adulthood.
They want that.
I see. And so there's this sense of, you know, I grew up in a, you know, troubled family. I have a lot of painfulness in my past. And I think Justin talks about this too. So I need to free myself, cut off ties, and make it on my own. And I think, you know, that sense of emotional progress and solitary emotional growth is new and problematic.
I don't know if you're okay. You are judging. It's problematic. I mean, are you sympathetic to that? If they had a difficult family, a troubled family, it wasn't nurturing for them. A, did we really have a whole country full of those? Or is that who you happen to talk to? And B, are you saying they're making a mistake here to move away?
So, you know, economic instability is, you know, highly connected with stress and with family turmoil and chaos. And those are the kinds of families that, you know, the people in the bottom are growing up in. And, you know, I'm not going to judge anyone's personal decision to move away. But I do think that when you define adulthood as cutting ties and focusing only on your own self-growth, you might, you know, also cut yourself out of a community and you might lose out on what could be some kind of solidarity.
Here's Mark writes, says, aversion to commitment in marriage, independence plus isolation equals an anxiety-riddled dog-eat-dog world. Talk about a dystopia in the making. And you're nodding right along, Jennifer. Hey, look, we don't want a dystopia here, but That's what you think you're describing.
That is what I'm describing. I'm seeing people become very hardened to the world around them, expecting betrayal, not wanting to invest in others, thinking that depending on others will only hurt them in the end, and embracing sort of self-sufficiency and self-reliance.
Justin, self-sufficiency and self-reliance, you know, again, those have old American patinas on them. Can they somehow be a problem in this new environment?
I think when the assumption is that they're the only resource they have is themselves, yes, because I do think it reinforces that idea of isolation and of feeling isolated, that they only have themselves to depend on. But also, I also think, frankly, that a lot of them who come from the kind of environments that Jennifer's talking about and the kind of environments I grew up in, they're right. They do only have it. You know, I mean, it's an isolation that's born also not only out of their assumptions but out of their circumstances.
It's not just an attitude; it's the reality they're facing. Depend on yourself, or you got nothing.
Exactly.
David in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hey Tom, how you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
So one thing that I think that's occurred. I'm 29 years old. I graduated college, and I work 5 jobs to get by. But one thing that I found is that when we were growing up, we were sold a certain narrative of what the American dream means, that you are what you do, that there's a linear path that you should take in a career, and that what you buy is who you are, and that you should be able to buy whatever you want. And that is the American dream. And I think a lot of young people are starting to stray away from that. Especially in urban areas like Boston, in Jamaica Plain, there's huge networks of solidarity for people. Skills shares. There's organizations that reach out to young people who are unemployed for volunteer opportunities. And so I think that is one thing where we're seeing a change. Granted, I speak from a place of privilege. And also, I think it's really problematic that even at universities where there are low-income students, credit card companies will reach out to these kids with little or no financial training, with little or no information, and they start raking up thousands of dollars of debt before they even enter the workforce. That's on top of student loans. And so I think we have to kind of find a way to engage with the economic system and the system of capital in our country and make it a little bit less predatory towards young people, and they may start to gain a little bit more trust.
David, I appreciate your call. 5 jobs. I'm trying to calculate how one even does that, but all right, 5 jobs there. Jennifer, what about it? David sees, yes, there may be some isolation, but also he says huge new networks of solidarity, sort of the shared economy idea. Your eyebrows are up skeptically, but he says he's living it.
Yeah, and if that's the case, that would be great. What I noticed in my work was much more of a decline of the kinds of solidarity of the past, like the unions and the churches or the women's groups. And so I think, and these are the kinds of groups that allowed people to go beyond thinking just about themselves and to, have a movement or fight for each other. I hope that we will see something, arise in their place. I didn't see that in my own research, but I'm hopeful that that is what will happen.
What personal implications do you anticipate for this generation, sort of one by one out of this milieu? They're up against this economy. That could change, but they're developing attitudes while they face it. What do you see coming from that personally? What do you see coming socially, politically, Jennifer?
Well, what's so interesting is that I conducted these interviews from 2008 to 2010.
So you're really in the heart of the downturn.
I was. But, following up on people, most of them are in exactly the same place that they were 3 years ago when I interviewed them. And so it's not that they were just delaying adulthood for a short time and then they got that job and they got married and it was fine. They're actually, in the same exact place, bouncing from job to job, still not sure where they're going to be living.
So
some
individually,
of them have had kids.
And then socially, politically, what do you see coming out of this?
I see a more sense of betrayal, more sense of bewilderment and distrust. People say to me, I look at the world, people are guilty until proven innocent because that's the way our government works. And when enough people believe that, you're going to see this withdrawal from, political life, from social life, and just a turning inward.
Turning inward, but I mean, everything has political implications. Is this a Rand Paul cohort?
So I think
is it right for something
sure,
else?
Sure, I think so. I mean, the people I spoke to are also not very likely to vote or get involved, but those ideas do resonate with them.
Justin, where do you see this taking us, this kind of sense of betrayal and redefinition that's sort of downward.
I think the thing that scares me the most about it is just the sense of exactly what Jennifer just said about less that it translates into any sort of political action and more into just disengagement and total apathy. I think a lot of that idea of being so sort of embattled post-college or post-whatever is results in this isolation, and that includes sort of political isolation and civic isolation. It's just, I think when people are this concerned about how they're going to make ends meet, you know, and then you wind up having a group of people that's a lot less engaged in their communities, whatever that might mean.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we've got all kinds of yes, plus pushback online. Dustin writes to us, he says, "We are waiting for the old guard to die or retire. We understand how to make our world work for us, but we have been betrayed by a mentality that's impoverished us and wasted our potential." So Dustin's standing there ready to go, Jennifer. It may not be the voice that you found around every corner, but it's definitely out there. Wow. It's a bracing view of a big swath of the generation coming into the workforce, in the workforce at the young end now. It's going to be really interesting to see where this one goes. Jennifer Silva's new book is coming up short. Jennifer, it's been great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Justin St. Germain, author of a wonderful new memoir, Son of a Gun, joining us today from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Justin, thanks for your insights today as well.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks, Jennifer.
We'll go out with a little bit of Dawes, When My Time Comes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us, listeners. This is On Point. I wanted to pay for my successes with all my defeats. And if heaven was all that was promised to me, why don't I pray for death? Oh, you can judge the whole world on the sparkle that you think it lacks. Yes, you can stare into the abyss, but it's staring right back.